Good evening, everyone. This is Pam Stack, your host, and you're listening to Authors on the Air. Tonight is my absolute honor to have with me Professor David Morrell, who has generously agreed to come on and talk about Ruler of the Night, which is the climax to his Victorian series about Thomas De Quincey, the Opium Eater. When you hear the story of the trilogies, you're going to be stunned, and I promise you, you're going to want to run right out and get this book. It's absolutely amazing. So stay right there. Let's talk more to to Professor David Morrell in just a second. Here we go. Glad you're with me tonight because you're in for a treat. David Morrell has joined me to talk about Ruler of the Night. I was speaking to him before the show, and I said that this book scared me because, and I'm a thriller lover. It's so well written, and it's so believable. You feel like you're in the 1950s Victorian England with the fog rolling in off the streets, and you just have to read the book to get the whole sense of it. I'm so honored to present Professor David Morrell, my friend. Thank you so much, David, for coming back on the show.
As you know, I'm always happy to be on the show, but we should explain why you're calling me professor. I was a professor, indeed, at the University of Iowa. I taught American literature, but as you know, in the thriller community, somehow the moniker stuck with me so that people still call me professor, and you know it's become it's a badge of honor I wear. I have to laugh, and hey, professor, what do you think? So I just thought we should explain.
But you earned it. I mean, you earned that, and indeed, you. I could call you Dr. Morrell, I suppose, because you have your PhD.
Well, I play a doctor. I don't play a doctor on TV, but you know, I could.
There you go. But you are one in real life, so there you go. And actually, you know who got me started on calling you professor? You have to know it's John Land.
Of course.
Because that's how he introduced us, and he's always called you professor.
And Steve Barry too.
It's funny, but I'm so grateful that you're here. You know, when we were talking before the show started, I was telling you that normally I devour a book in, you know, a little bit less than a day. And it isn't that your book is very long at all. It's just slightly over, I think, 320 pages or something. But because of the detail and the nuance and everything about the way you write, your prose is just so exceptional. I really took my time, and there were places that I wanted to read it out loud because it sounded so beautiful to hear it. It's a different way to experience a book, but it did indeed scare me. I felt like I was walking the streets in the 1850s in Victorian London. So thank you for that experience. It's something that doesn't happen to me very often.
Well, as you know, I'm a research fanatic. And when
when I
had the idea for this, there would be three novels. It would be a trilogy, and I knew this was going to occupy several years. It turned out to be 7 years, and the research I did became so immersive, and one thing led to another, and I quickly realized that, I mean, I mentioned earlier I was a professor of American literature in a former life, and this was a big jump to be now in the Victorian world of 1850s London. So I said if I was going to do this, I had to really throw myself into it and give myself the equivalent of a PhD in Victorian studies. And so then the goal became, because I was so convinced that I was there, And you know, parenthetically, some people know the story. I wanted to disappear
right.
into Victorian London because my wonderful granddaughter, Natalie, 14 years old, had died in 2009 from a rare bone cancer, Ewing sarcoma,
yes.
that my son had died from many years earlier, and
right.
I was just devastated. And I seized upon the opportunity to go back in time as some kind of therapy, as a way to escape the deep depression I'd fallen into. And Thomas De Quincey, this real-life guy and from the period, was just so fascinating to me that, in a way, I think he saved me. It was almost like he was reaching across the centuries. And my goal became, since I was convinced I was there, I really felt I was time-traveling, my goal became that I wanted to make readers feel they were there also. And so you're giving me a high compliment. If you felt you were there, that was the point. Hooray that you felt that way. Not that you were scared. I'm sorry you were scared, but
no,
you know, you had
any mercy. That's what you should evoke when you read a thriller. You should have moments of tension like that. The reader, it was so real to me that, you know, I thought about this book for a long, long, long time. And of course, having read Inspector of the Dead, the second book, and Murder is a Fine Art, the first book, I was very much anticipating speaking to you and, of course, reading the book. So I find it fascinating that you use Thomas De Quincey as your character. How in the world did he come into your view and you decided to use him?
Well, it's one of those, when I teach writing to students at conferences and all, I sometimes say that the difference between a storyteller and a reader is that readers are civilians, and it's our job to be aware all the time. And if something interests us, an ordinary person would say, "Oh, that's interesting," and then sort of, you know, go on with their lives. Whereas a writer says, "That's interesting. I wonder why that interested me." And then the rabbit hole starts. Then as you start chasing it,
right.
at least myself, as I start chasing that, I begin learning things about myself. And sometimes, you know, I say, all right, I get it. And other times it's so fascinating that in this case, as I said, I was willing to devote 7 years to doing this. But you asked how this came about, it's because of grief. My daughter, God bless her, it was her daughter who had died, naturally was seeking out books and movies about grief, and she had found a film about Charles Darwin's nervous breakdown after his favorite daughter died. The book is called, or the film is called, Creation, and Darwin had, this massive nervous breakdown with all kinds of symptoms, headaches and stomach problems and boils and name it, it was wrong with him. But it didn't make
right.
sense from a Victorian medical perspective because they couldn't tie it all together. But whereas we in the 20th century, 21st century now, we would get it. The guy was in grief so much it
sure.
ruined his health. And at the
right.
end of the movie, the climax, so to speak, a guy shows up, a friend, and he's been doing a little research, and he delivers the big message in which he says, "You know, Charles, there are people like Thomas De Quincey who say you can be controlled by thoughts and emotions you don't know you have." And I listened
wow.
to that, and I thought, what the hell did I just hear? And the movie's set in 1850s, but this guy, Thomas De Quincey, sounded like Freud, and I'm thinking, nah, they're making this up. As soon as the movie ended, I ran off to do my customary research and found out that Thomas De Quincey anticipated Freud by 70 years and believed that you've heard me quote this and I love to do it,
yes.
the human mind
yes.
is composed of chasms and sunless abysses, layer upon layer, in which there are secret chambers where alien natures hide undetected. And
it's a beautiful quote too.
It's De Quincey at his best. And I said, I can do something with this. I can have a guy in the 1850s who understands the chasms and sunless abysses of the human mind, working with Scotland Yard, the detective division only recently founded, and they think they're hot shots because they can make plaster casts of footprints. So the fascination became, how do these detectives trying to figure out what it is to be a detective, what do they make of a guy that's talking to them about this nonsense that, from their point of view, of
right.
the chasms and sunless abysses? And so I was off to the races.
There you go. You know, it was interesting because De Quincey himself is a study in contrast, for sure, from some horrible things that happened to him to some really interesting things that happened. But ultimately, he was his own worst enemy, and that's really unfortunate because he was so badly addicted to opium. But nevertheless, he's a fabulous, he's a great character, and
he was
so glad.
Go on, finish your thought.
I'm so glad that you used him in the way that you did, in the manner that you did, because he's the quintessential, almost like the anti-hero hero. I don't know how to explain it, but he's such an interesting character. Do you know what I mean, David?
Well, oh, absolutely. He had had a toothache, and he was a student at Oxford. And he went to a chemist, and he purchased a bottle of laudanum, which was a mixture of opium and brandy. And in those days, laudanum, opium, it was perfectly legal. You could buy it anywhere. You could buy it cheaply. It was the only effective painkiller anybody had. But they knew to be careful with it, and they had a skull and crossbones on the bottle, and they had poison on the bottle, and they had overdose instructions on the bottle, and most people, you know, approached it with great care, as he did himself for about 5 years. And then, as so often happens with what we call recreational use, it tipped over, and he was seized by the drug. And at the height of his addiction, it seems impossible to believe this, but it's true, a tablespoon of laudanum, again, that's brandy and powdered opium, a tablespoon, if you weren't used to it, would kill you. They used it in like one or two, five drops in water is the way they applied it. And he was drinking 16 ounces of this stuff a day. And it didn't kill him. And then we have 16 ounces.
That's amazing. But he had his own demons as well.
He had a very odd
background with his mother. He wanted to be wealthy, but he couldn't hang on to money. So he had a lot of children, and he had a lot of brothers and sisters, didn't he? He was a case study unto his own. When you were doing your research, though, David, the amount of work you've done, and I know because we've spoken about this when we've seen each other and we've spoken about it on previous shows, is such an enormous amount of research. Did you have to use the services of research assistants just to help you keep all of this organized in some fashion?
I've never done that. I'm blessed with what I believe is called an eidetic memory. And that means, and some people listening know what I'm talking about, that when you read a book, it's like snapshots. You later you can say, all right, it's on page 218, the top of the right-hand page. As I get older, this ability isn't as strong as it once was, but it's still pretty strong. And so I had, you know, shelves and shelves and shelves of Victorian studies about De Quincey, about London, about Queen Victoria, about the period, and what made it what it was. My favorite example is that a few years before this starts in 1851, there had been the First World's Fair, what they called the Crystal Palace Exhibition, in Hyde Park, and styles changed, and women began to wear hoop dresses with either metal or whale's teeth hoops under their dresses, and and because of this, because the dresses had a tendency, obviously, to bounce up, so they wore a lot of undergarments, and then they put lead weights in the dresses to stop them from bouncing up, and then they did this and that, and they had to cover all the hoops with what amounted to 10 yards of ruffled satin. And so, you know, doing the research and looking at various studies, I learned that the average woman, middle or upper class, had clothes that weighed 37 pounds.
I don't want to be out of a T-shirt and shorts, I have to tell you. So
I hear you.
That's torture.
I'm getting to be more like Jeff Bridges in The Big Lebowski, and more I'm shuffling around in my house coat, you know. And I mean, the whole thought of that is so beyond anything. But what it's worth pointing out that if you read Dickens, if you read Trollope, Wilkie Collins, any of the really wonderful novelists of the period, they don't explain this stuff because they took it for granted. And they assumed that everybody knew this, so why explain it? So the gift I had was for these Victorian thrillers was that I knew stuff that wasn't in the original books but was implied. So my task and my joy was to write these books so that I stated, such as the 37 pounds of clothing, that they didn't bother mentioning then. So that's one reason why the period becomes so vivid in these three books. It is because I parted the curtain and I revealed the secrets that they never thought were important to reveal in their own work.
Well, they certainly are, and it gives a more vivid picture of the period and of characters, their movement, everything. So, I'm glad that you did that because the authenticity is just amazing in the book.
Well, another example, I had read, Queen Victoria's in these books. And so she's been written about a lot. So how do the downside of doing a lot of research is you throw it all in there and the story, disappears. And by all means, my job is to serve the story. So with Queen Victoria, how was I going to, in a convenient, efficient way, communicate the impression she gave? And, she was shorter, she was somewhat overweight and all that. But we all know that. But this detail, it took me three or four biographies, and I finally found what I wanted. Her mother had groomed her to be queen. And so from the age of four, her mother put scoops of holly under her collar. Holly, if you're not familiar with it, is a very sharp, it's like a maple leaf, only it's brittle and very sharp, very stingy. And she put the holly under Victoria's collar so that only if Victoria stood as straight as humanly possible would she not be stung by the holly under her collar. And that, so from the age of four, she was trained to walk like a queen. And, when you have that in mind, she walks like she has holly under her collar. It might have taken me, a couple of nights of reading in order to find that wonderful detail.
That's an interesting one. And now I'm going to be thinking about that for a long time and how awful it is. Because in my younger day and a lot of my friends and all, we had to go to like charm classes where, put a book on your head and you had to walk very straight so the book wouldn't fall over. I much prefer the thought of a book than holly under my collar, though. I will tell you that. It would be probably bougainvillea, in South Florida. So
I don't think they have charm school anymore, do they?
I don't think they do either. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's
it's a nice concept. You're your etiquette school. It's a nice concept because you learned how to set a table, you remembered manners, you remembered to say please and thank you, you learned how to write a thank you note, and, you know, there was a lot to be said for it. It was very now probably considered sexist, but
yeah.
Boys and girls could use with a dose of that. They could go through a dose of etiquette training.
I'm a big favorite of it. I was talking to somebody about this today, and I said one of my rules of thumb is, if I'm a little puzzled about how I should behave, I ask myself, what would Cary Grant do?
There you go. What a great role model for you.
Some people listening might not know who Cary Grant was, in which case, haul off and watch North by Northwest, and you'll find out.
There you go. Absolutely. I want to recall a conversation that you and I had a while ago, I think it was during one of the first or second interviews you and I ever did together. You spoke very passionately about adults not daydreaming anymore, and you told me that you learned a lot about yourself. As a matter of fact, you self-identified very easily when you continued to daydream. You thought it was really important. It was important to the writing process, to living and all. Can we revisit that conversation, David? Because to
Absolutely.
Me, it's fascinating. It is such a wonderful thing. I daydream all the time. And when in school, you know, I used to get the back of my head swatted to pay attention. But I constantly daydream. Tell me your point of view on it again.
It's a kind of national repression. I don't get it, but we all had an experience when I was in grade school. You know, if you were looking out the window, the teacher would say, yeah, you're wasting all the students' time daydreaming. It's a waste. When, in fact, that's where all the good stuff comes. So when I was learning to write, I was at Penn State, and I had met a science fiction writer. I don't write science fiction, but, you know, prose is prose. And he he was willing to teach me. His name was Philip Klass, and his pen name was William Penn. And he'd been part of the golden age of science fiction in the 50s. And he had a theory that everyone has a dominant emotion caused by, you know, the way life turned out for us. And some people are angry, and some people are envious, and some people are, God help us, hateful. And in some cases, the emotions are such that maybe we feel shame about them and won't recognize them. But Philip Klass said that if you want to be a writer, it helps to know what's driving you. And he said that this dominant emotion was like a ferret that darted around inside people, would-be writers, and that our task was to try to get close enough to get a sense of that emotion and why we felt it. It is, if you like, a form of self-psychoanalysis. And I didn't understand what he was talking about until I was working on what became my first real short story. I'd written many short stories, but they were all terrible. But the one I wrote was the consequence of a very powerful daydream in which I was being stalked in a forest. Now, this is a very familiar theme now, but in 1968, it had not been used much except, you know, in genre stories like The Most Dangerous Game. And the experience was so powerful and transcendent. It went on for quite a while. I was overwhelmed by the daydream. And I understood what he was talking about. And when I showed him the story, he said, what happened to you? And then he told me what he'd suspected for a very long time was that my dominant emotion was fear. And that's not something, you know, that people normally want to talk about or admit. But I had a hellacious childhood. I was in an orphanage for a time, and my father had died in combat. My mother was unable to support me. She put me in an orphanage. Then she remarried, but the guy she married hated children, and they fought all the time. I spent most of my nights under the bed, afraid. telling stories to myself. And so, you know, I sort of repressed all that. And then this brilliant man, you know, brought it all out and showed me who I was. And I was then able to channel a lot of my experiences into stories that would be accessible for other people, not just autobiography. But my view is that many people, we daydream all the time. The miracle is we don't have more car accidents because we're capable of daydreaming and still functioning. But with a writer, with a fiction writer, those daydreams are what it's all about. That's the inspiration. And I know some writers who just dismiss all that and then struggle like crazy to come up with some forced idea that nobody wants to write, when the bubbling up of the subconscious in the form of daydreams is happening all the time. So all of my stories came from these daydreams and my willingness to look at the emotions, not always pleasant ones, and to realize that they were the stuff of what I hope would be powerful narratives.
It's a fascinating thing to me. It really is. It's truly fascinating. I want to kind of switch around again and go back to your Professor Mantle and ask you to put on that cap. A lot of people want to write books, but a lot of people are not going to be good authors, are they?
I hate to say this. I have gone around. I did teach fiction writing once at Penn State. I did not teach fiction writing at the University of Iowa at the workshop. I was in the English department. I taught the American novel. But I have taught outside university atmosphere. I bet I have taught many thousands of people about my views about writing and how I think it should be done and all that. And I've done this for maybe the last 20 years, and I'm not talking now about established writers, but I'm talking about people who want to be writers, who are sort of struggling. I have seldom met people who had the drive. To be a successful fiction writer, you must want it almost more than life itself. It requires a drive and a discipline that is almost superhuman. And I meet people who have maybe the gift, but they don't have the drive, or I have people who have the drive but can't tell a story, can't tell a joke, let alone, write a novel. So Hemingway said discipline, talent, and luck.
And, you know, that's interesting that you say it. I was just having this conversation the other day with someone who's a very, very good writer and who's considered a mid-list writer, and wondered, you know, why my books are every bit as good as anybody else's, and why haven't I reached the top? And I said, I truly believe that part of the equation is you're writing the right thing at the right time, and that maybe that's the luck you're talking about.
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
I know I could not write a book.
Yeah, I know I cannot write a fiction book. Now, I could write a nonfiction story. I can write you a beautiful letter. I can do a great promotion. But and it's not that I don't have the discipline for it. I just don't have the knack for storytelling. I could tell a short story. But I think you have to be a storyteller at heart to be able
to... Well, you have to keep at it, you know, and our friend Steve Barry, you know, who wrote throughout the 90s, and he couldn't get published. And then Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code comes out, and the market shifts, and Steve has all these novels that, you know, he'd written, but that there wasn't a market then, but suddenly there was. I mean, who can account for this? And this is part of the heartbreak of it. I mean, you must want it almost more than life itself. In what other profession would you sit down every day by yourself and write and write and write every day for a year on the foolish assumption that somebody else is going to find it interesting? I mean, it takes a really unique person, and most, God bless them, most people finally say, you know what, I don't have the energy. And what you said is true. I know lots of people, they're wonderful writers, but they didn't write at that moment in history the kind of book that everybody would find interesting. And believe me, at this moment in the United States, with a tremendous, and this is not a political comment, everybody would agree that the country is divided. The division in the country is bound to create confusion in fiction writers who thought the world was one way and now believe it's another way, or maybe it isn't. So, you know, who are they writing for? What is the market? And in a certain odd way, you know, the division is like what was going on when I started First Blood back in the late 1960s. Because, you know, we had that same everybody's at each other's throats feeling. And I was able to find a way to write about that at the right time. I mean, who could have predicted it? It took me 3 years to write the thing, and all the doubts that racked me, and you know, so talent, determination, and luck. It's a baffling thing, and it's heartbreaking. I know so many people writers that I love, and you know, some of them have succeeded, but unfortunately, by far the majority do not have the success of the. You know, if you look at Gone Girl, arguably that book would not have been a success if not for the emotions created by the 2008 recession.
Yes, I agree with you.
And if she'd written
crazy,
that book 5 years earlier, it would not have worked.
Or 5 years later, even.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it may not have done as well. I agree with you.
Yeah, yeah.
I agree with you
100%. Sometimes books come out, you know, when they were meant to. So, you know, I think about this every day. You know, I sit down, you know, let's go back to the books we're talking about. When I started Murder as a Fine Art in 2009, you know, and people were saying, you know, you created Rambo and, you know, American novelist, and now you're going to go to the Victorian era. You know, what are you thinking? But I was obsessed. I had this double burden of grief. And I just wanted to get the hell out of Dodge. I just wanted to get back to someplace. So I was motivated by something that had nothing to do with the market or contemporary reading or even my fans. I had no guarantee they would follow me. I just knew that I was going to be sane if every day I read and wrote about 1850s London. And that passion carried me through, and God bless my readers. You know, they came aboard and, you know, with great enthusiasm, but it, you know, could have been the other way.
Well, I want to kind of not talk about writing just for a moment and talk about the many accolades that you received this year. It's been a banner year to be David Morrell. First, you were honored at Thriller Fest with the Lifetime Achievement Award, and you were also honored at BoucherCon, of which I am so sorry that I did not get to see you and congratulate you in person.
Well, you weren't well.
Because of your fabulous body of work, and you so richly deserve it. And, you know, I've read all your books, and you, if you recall when we first met, I had a tattered copy of Brotherhood of the Rose. And
yes.
John Land teased me, and he said, Pam, they're selling them over in the book room. And I said, no, this is my book.
No, this is my copy,
this is my copy. And you graciously signed it for me, and you also signed Shimmer for me. So, you know, it was so funny, but those are my babies. I have my family, I have my cats, and I have my books. And they're all mine. So, you know, when I die, the books go with me. No one will ever get my books. Whether I go up or down, I'm going to have something to read, I figure. But congratulations.
Frank Sinatra was buried with a bottle of Jack Daniels. So
there you go.
God,
he couldn't drink anything nicer. That's so funny.
I know.
So, David, when you're not writing, and I know that you are writing almost all the time, but when you're not writing, what do you do for fun? I don't think I've ever asked you that. We've always talked about writing, and so forgive me for neglecting that part of your life, but I would imagine that you do other things besides read and write.
I have a big commitment to physical motion. In the summer, I swim a lot vigorously. In the fall and winter, I'm on the treadmill or I'm hiking. or when my knees would stand it, I was a compulsive tennis player. And before that, I was a jogger. I jogged like 10 miles every day. I believe that because I sit so much, you know, it's not normal to be sitting that long. So I like to move. In addition to that, when the weather allows, in the summer and all, I'm a gardener. I really, really, particularly vegetable gardening, I have a great passion for that. I'm a pilot, a private pilot. You mentioned the Shimmer a while ago, and the book about the famous Martha Lights, mysterious
right.
Martha Lights. Because of that novel where the lights had been chased by aircraft, I knew that I needed to learn about how airplanes would function in that way. So I took some lessons and finally got a pilot's license. And I was flying, in fact, I live in New Mexico near the Rio Grande, and I flew up along the Rio Grande Gorge on Saturday, and, you know, it was really transcendent, looked at the snow on the mountains and what have you. So at the end of my days, because I'm looking at a computer so much, I watch movies, but not in a casual way. I don't do anything without throwing myself into it, and so I know a lot about movies and how they're made, and
oh, wonderful.
My wife and I, we watch at least a movie a night for reasons other than, you know, watching gunfights. And
oh, wonderful.
And, what else?
You have a very busy life. Would you like to take a phone call? We have somebody on hold, so let's see who's calling.
Oh, somebody is calling.
Hi,
somebody.
Area code 713. You're live on the air. Who's this?
Yes, this is Kay Kendall in Houston.
Hey, Kay, how
Hi,
are you?
Kay.
I'm fine.
How are you?
I'm just fine. I'm delighted to hear you both, two of my favorite people.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. My question is about people, Professor Morrell, who are forced by their publishing houses to do at least a book a year. And I think you're fortunate because you're not pushed to do that. You seem to be naturally prolific, but I don't think you have that, you know, that industrial feeling about your books. They kind of come out of something real rather than just push, push, push. Do you see this as a bad thing for mysteries and thrillers?
I have good friends. My good friend Douglas Preston, writing with Lincoln Child, they do two books a year and sometimes three. And Doug and I have talked about it, but he just says the ideas come to him so fast that, you know, they're just ready to keep working. They love it. So I suspect. You know, it's a question of temperament. We do know some people who are doing it because they want to earn more and more money, which is not necessarily a bad thing, obviously. But maybe sometimes the books feel rushed. Not the Doug Preston and Lincoln Child books. I want to be clear about that. But I'm trying to do a distinction between, you know, the books that seem like they're written out of passion and some that are written for the marketplace. Who knows? My feeling is this. When I started, I noticed that the average career lasted about 20 years. And the reason that they didn't last longer was that the author tended to do the same thing again and again until readers got tired and the author got tired. And I thought, you know what, I'm not going to write the same thing every time. Now, this hurt me and helped me. You know, I could have written spy in the 1980s. I wrote The Brotherhood of the Rose and several influential spy novels, and I could have continued doing that. But after a while, I got the idea. And I thought, you know, would it be better if I learned if I went in another direction? So it seems, at least in my career, that every decade I've, sort of, they're all thrillers, they're action and suspense, but they go in different directions. They're all risky for that reason. But I think that's why next year will be the 45th anniversary of First Blood.
Oh, my.
45 years. I mean, this stunned
it is
me
amazing.
When I realized it. I couldn't believe
it's
it.
It's amazing,
you know?
To think about that. Yeah,
and,
it's amazing.
And I think
but, Kay, let me ask you, I hear from a lot of authors who say, I'm kind of glad that I have a deadline because it forces me to pay attention to what I'm doing. And knowing that they have that deadline is kind of a taskmaster, although invisible. So I hear that. What I also hear is when publishers say, I want you to produce 2 or 3 books a year, and that becomes an issue too. So I don't know if that helps or not, but Preston and Child will be with me next month, and you can ask them how they do it too.
Okay. Let's be clear. These guys, I love these guys. So I don't want anybody saying I was saying anything bad. I'm not. They love
doing,
and they're very creative. But you know,
right.
the there is the reverse that can happen, and you know, so you have to just figure out you know, why you're doing it.
Right, yeah. I was at a conference, a smaller one, where the guest of honor was extremely prolific, and the way that author spoke, that person I won't even say he or she because I don't really want to. the person was talking about product.
Yeah, this drives me crazy. I've known for a quote I once said that the books we write should be the autobiography of our souls.
Yes.
And that our books are read in the order in which they were written, people would have a very clear idea of the emotional passages through which we had moved in this lifetime journey. That's just, you know, how I do it. And I've been very fortunate. My publisher has never said, hey, you know, what's new, what's next, and all that. It's a blessing in a way, to have that leisure.
Right. Well, by the same token, though, you know, there are newer authors who are coming into the marketplace and who are quite good, but they also recognize that they have to run their business, their writing as a business. Their books have to become their business simply because they're not signed up with the traditional publishing is gone. I mean, you have four to five big publishers now. The money isn't there to market the way that it used to be. You know, I can remember spending many a long weekend sitting on the floor of bookstores and reading everything I could because I couldn't afford to buy everything. But when you are deciding, making a decision, say, to be self-published or small press published, I think those authors have to almost look at it like a product. And that's unfortunate. Not that they're not creative as well, but it's a balance for sure. Wouldn't you say, Professor?
You've heard me
yes.
In my two mantras, right? I have two mantras.
Yes.
One is be a first-rate version of yourself and not a second-rate version of another author. and that's my
Absolutely.
Primary mantra. And there's a secondary one, which is, which follows from the first, which is don't chase the market. You'll always see its backside.
Right. And
right.
that is true.
Yeah.
Like we were talking about, like, you know, Girl Gone.
Yeah. That'll be the sequel.
Yeah. there you go. You see, who would have thunk it? You just don't know what the market's going to do. So you can't really chase it because you may be at the end of it. You're at the end of it all the time, I think.
Write the book you were meant to write.
Mm-hmm.
If you make a living at it, great. I was trained, you know, don't quit your day job until you've got 3 or 4 years of money saved so that you can live at the comfort that you require. And I taught for 16 years before. I could afford to quit teaching, but I didn't see the point. I thought it was actually a good balance, and it wasn't until 16 years after I began teaching at a university that I said, you know what, I think it's time. There's a wonderful freedom if you don't have to worry, if you don't have to write scared, let's put it that way.
Right. Well, you spoke about our friend Steve Barry. You asked Steve about how long he held on to his legal practice. He was already published and had several books before he decided to sell his practice or close it up. You know, he was nervous about it because it's such a risky business.
Yeah.
Ryan was grateful for him, and he enjoyed the writing.
He and I talked about that.
Yes. Yeah, it's amazing. So, well, thank you, Kay. And I know I've taken up so much of your time, David. I just love talking to you. I always learn something new when I speak with you.
If we have time for one little story.
We do. We have time. I just didn't want
to
take your time.
Tomorrow's a big day for me because Ruler of the Night, the third Victorian thriller comes out, and we were talking about why people write, and the reason I wrote the book was because it's all three of these books are about major crimes that affected the changed Victorian culture. The Murders of Fine Arts about the first publicized mass murder in English history, not Jack the Ripper.
Right.
The second is about the numerous attempts to assassinate Queen Victoria. And this one is about the first murder on an English train. Now, objectively, somebody would say, yeah, I get it. They had a train, and my God, somebody got murdered. So I could see that it'd be shocking. But I just wanted to tell this little story so people understand how remarkable this was. Trains were different back then. There was no central corridor in what the English called carriages and Americans called cars. There was no central corridor. Instead, the carriages were composed of separate small compartments capable of seating eight people, four on each side, facing one another. There was a door on one side of the compartment, a door on the other side of the compartment. And when the train began to leave the station, the guard on the platform locked the doors. The windows were barred. You were in a cell, a very small cell. And in one case, the first murder on an English train, a banker got into a first-class compartment, and they're waiting for the train, and nobody else is in it. It's only room for eight people, but it's just him. And then somebody else got in the compartment, and the train whistled, and the guard locked them in. And the reason for the locking was that they were afraid that people would open. It was a novelty, the trains were, and so they were afraid to open the door and lean out and get hit by a pole or something going past. So it was for their safety. But in this case, there's the banker, the door is locked, the train pulls out of the station, and the other guy pulled out a knife. And as you know, for Alien, remember with Alien the movie, it said in space no one can hear you scream. Well, it was the same with Victorian trains. In that compartment, no one could hear that man scream, and even if they could, no one could have helped him because there was no way to get from one compartment to the other. And that fear that we were talking about earlier, that terror.
Yes.
I thought this is really powerful stuff, and that's how the book opens with that first murder, and the plot is different. The way it happened is the way it happened in real life, and I just had a really interesting time learning about trains from the era and how they were put together and the bars and the locks and all that. So anyway, Ruler of the Night.
I'm a huge fan of trains, and even those trains. I'm not going to give away any of the story to listeners or readers, but for those of you who have been listening, David Morrell's Ruler of the Night is one of the most exceptional books that I've ever written, read. And I have read many, many, many books. But I will tell you, honestly, Professor, that still, when someone asked me what five books will I take with me if I have to be, you know, go to a deserted island someplace, Brotherhood of the Rose is always on that list.
It was a lucky book for me. It's the only.
It was genre changing though. Nobody was writing spy thrillers. They really did.
They were writing them in different fashions. They were two train tracks, to use our metaphor. In the one in the American spy novel, there was a lot of running around and action, but terrible spy technique. And in the British version, there was brilliant spy technique, but everybody sat around in dark rooms and plotted. There was no action. And I had, in the early 80s, I had this, you know, I don't know, you call it an epiphany. I said, maybe you could marry the two so you could have authentic tradecraft and spy stuff with the action. And so in those days, it was very difficult to do the research without the internet. But I found people who had been trained by the CIA, and you know, they taught me, you know, the way spies worked. And to this day, I'm sort of kidding myself maybe, but people tell me that when they read Brotherhood of the Rose, it feels like it was written yesterday. And
it really does.
It was an important book for me.
No, it's one of my go-to books. There are about five books that I will read over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. I just need to have that experience of reading for the first time. It may have been the 10th time, but I have to read it every year. I have to read Brotherhood of the Rose.
Oh, you're
kind. I have to read something by Pat Conroy. I have to read something by Trevanian. I've got to read a romance book, and I've got to read a fantasy book every single year, because the books impacted me in such a way that they actually changed how and what I read. So that's a gift that you gave me a long time ago, and that's why that book, as tattered and torn as it was so important to me, to bring it to you and ask for your signature.
Well, it's
Professor
talisman.
David Morrell, thank you so much. It is.
Oh, you're kind. Thank you.
It is.
Your enthusiasm is so wonderful.
I'm so glad that you came, and I hope to see you soon. And I hope that the rest of the year is joyful for you. Are you working on another project, or are you giving yourself a break?
I'm in Victorian withdrawal. I came up as in a bathysphere to the modern world, and I looked around. No kidding. I'm really freaked. You know, every day I was able to escape. I'm not lying. Every day I was able to escape, you know, into the fog, so to speak. You know, I felt so muffled and so protected, even though they're hair-raising stories. And then, you know, so I finished the end, and I did what I had to do to, you know, for the copy editing. And then I looked around, and I said, holy cow, this feels really weird. I'm like De Quincey when he tried to get off the laudanum. I'm in Victorian withdrawal.
They're hurt. That's so funny. Well, I hope you enjoy it. Come out of it slowly. There's no rush. And don't read the newspaper for sure. You don't want to be traumatized by that. God. Thank you so much. You and I are going to talk again. I just know we will. And I'm so glad that you were with me tonight. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you. Okay.
And you and I will talk again soon. Have a great night.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Good night. And that, my friends, is the brilliant David Morrell. Wednesday night, I'm going to be speaking to noir author Greg Barth. And on Friday, I'm going to be speaking to bestselling author Rob Hart. Thank you so much for being with me. Go get Ruler of the Night by Professor Morrell. You're going to love the book, I promise you. Thank you for being with me, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Have a good night, everyone.